Okay, thank you, Debbie. Good afternoon. Welcome, everyone. I'm going to call to order the Senate Committee on Workforce. Today is Wednesday, March 15th, 2017. Today we'll have a combined public hearing on two, what are we calling, PERS bills, Senate Bill 560 and Senate Bill 913. I apologize for the delay. These are Senator Knope's bills, therefore we could not go forward without the man of the hour. But he is here now. And just for clarification before we get going, we heard Senate Bill 560 about 3 weeks ago, was it?
In February.
February. And that bill has a total of 7 amendments. And today we are going to discuss the bill. We talked about it previously, but we're going to be going over in more detail, and Senator Knope will be testifying to the 7 amendments. And then Senate Bill 913, which is also Senator Knope's bills, there's a lot of overlap between Senate Bill 913 and Senate Bill 560 with the 7 amendments. And for those of you who are not familiar with how the legislature works, welcome to how transparent and easy we make it. We make it quite confusing, so I apologize for that. And if anybody has any questions about what all of that means, we have Debbie here that can answer questions if you want any of that clarified as we go forward. So in order to have an open conversation about both bills and the amendments, I'm going to open up a public hearing on both of the bills so we can go over them. So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 560 and Senate Bill 913. And this is our, I went ahead and I jumped the gun and explained what we're going to do. And Deborah's going to summarize the bills. They're rather lengthy. She's going to talk about each of the amendments. So we're going to hear from Deborah a little bit about what each of the amendments does for Senate Bill 560, and then we'll ask Senator Knope to testify. So please, Deborah.
Okay, thank you, Chair Taylor. Senate Bill 560 is sponsored by Senators Knope, Bertschiger, Boquist, Ferrioli, Hansel, Olson, Thatcher, Winters, and Representative Nierman. As Senator Taylor mentioned, you heard SB 560 on February 13th. The original bill redirects employee contributions from their IAP account to a newly created account that will be used to fund member pensions. Today you'll hear 7 amendments that would replace the bill. The Dash 2 amendment changes the calculation of benefits under the PERS full formula for service after January 1st, 2018. It decreases the pension multiplier from 1.67% to 1%, a final average salary per year of service for general service members, and from 2% to 1.2% for police and fire members. The Dash 3 amendment requires the Public Employees Retirement Board to adopt actuarial equivalency factor tables for computing payments to PERS members and others as needed, and at least every 2 years. It establishes an assumed interest rate of 3.5% to convert account balances to monthly lifetime annuities, decreasing the PERS Board's current long-term investment return assumption of 7.5%. The Dash 4 amendment changes the definition of salary for purposes of calculating the final average salary of Tier 1 and Tier 2 PERS members. It adds an exclusion to the definition of salary or other advantages for any lump sum payment for accumulated unused vacation leave or other unused paid leave accrued on or after January 1st, 2018. The Dash 5 amendment for members of OPSERP, not including police officers or firefighters, who establish membership in the pension program on or after the effective date of the Act, it increases the normal retirement age to 67 years of age and the early retirement age to 57 years of age, regardless of the number of active service years. The Dash 6 amendment requires the public employers that hire retired PERS member on or after the effective date of the Act to contribute the percentage of the retired member's salary to PERS that would have been contributed if the retired member were an active member. The Dash 8 amendment increases the waiting period to become a PERS member from 6 months to 12 months for eligible employees employed in qualifying positions on or after the effective date of the Act. And the Dash 9 amendment increases from 600 to 1,000 service hours in a calendar year that eligible employees employed in a qualifying position on or after the effective date of the Act must complete to become PERS members. It requires that PERS members establishing membership in the pension program on or after the effective date of the Act complete at least 1,000 service hours in each of 5 calendar years to become vested in the pension program. Senate Bill 913 is sponsored by Senator Knope. It requires the PERS board to adopt actuarial equivalency factor tables for computing payments to members and others as needed and at least every 2 years and no later than January 1st, 2018. It changes the assumed interest rate to the lesser of the rate determined by the board or the current rate at the time of adoption for valuing annuity benefits by the Federal Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. For new members of OPSERP, not including police officers or firefighters, it increases the normal retirement age to 67 years of age and early retirement age 57 years of age, regardless of the number of active service years. It requires the PERS board to establish member contribution accounts for each active PERS member. It redirects the employee contributions to the individual account program on or after January 1st, 2018 to those accounts and applies amounts accruing on or after January 1st, 2018 to the cost of members' pensions or other retirement benefits. It prohibits employers from contributing on the employee's behalf on or after January 1st, 2018, or after the expiration of collective bargaining agreement that's in effect on January 1st, 2018. For PERS members retiring on or after January 1st, 2018, it changes the calculation of their final average salary for purposes of determining the member's full formula benefit. It establishes that a person other than a member of the Legislative Assembly or judge who is not a PERS member when appointed or elected to an elected public office may not become a PERS member for purpose of that position, but may participate in a state-deferred compensation plan in certain circumstances. It requires a recalculation of employer contribution rates to reflect the savings attributable to the Act and makes the corrected rates effective July 1st, 2017. It declares an emergency effective on passage, and there are no amendments to this bill.
Thank you. Senator Mona Sampson.
Yes. Is it possible to have that summary on OLIS?
It is.
Is it on OLIS?
Yes.
And how
that is in the staff measure summary.
Staff measure summary. Thank you very much.
Yes. Deborah is very thorough at that, we know. So we greatly appreciate that. This is the hardworking person behind the scenes. So we are first going to call up Senator Cano to come talk about the bills, please. Would you like to remain here? Would you like to go down and there?
I'll just remain here. Thank you, Madam Chair, because it won't take very long, what she said. So basically, the goal in putting forth amendments and the additional bill was really to create transparency in things that are being considered and hopefully make it easier when we decide what direction we're going to move, that the items have already been drafted, and so they just need to be redrafted into whatever final product we decide if we're going to move forward. And so I don't know that, honestly, that I can add anything to what Deborah has already presented, because I think she did a really accurate job of telling you about the amendments and telling you about Senate Bill 913. I will tell you, Senate Bill 913 was kind of derived out of a letter that we'd received in the PERS work group that we had last fall, and I just wanted to make sure the person who gave us that letter had the things that she had identified introduced in a vehicle if, you know, they decided that they wanted to try to talk about those issues, that they were all kind of in one place. And so, because there is a lot of overlap between 560, 559, and 913. And I've received some email correspondence from individuals who have some concerns, and I don't necessarily think that Senate Bill 913 will be the vehicle. It may not even be 560. It's going to be up to the chair to determine what vehicle we use that probably has a right relating clause. And so I don't think people should assume that 913 is you know, what we're going to do, and that's what it's going to include, because I don't think we've come to that determination yet, and that's why we have the public hearings and, you know, are continuing to take testimony. So with that, Madam Chair, wherever you'd like to go with inviting people to testify.
Great. Thank you. Yes, Senator Hansel.
When we looked at, the last time we met, we looked at all the proposals. We had both the staff from PERS and LC there to determine yay or nay from their point of view. Have we had the same, have they had a chance to look at these amendments in the same way? And if so, what's the result?
So why don't we, so we can have them come up, but what's happening now is that they have, I'm not sure that they're ready for, are you ready for today or are you ready for, you, I don't want to put you on the spot, the if you can come on up, Marisa. So this is obviously an enormous amount of information, yeah. And she, the LC takes her job very seriously. and we have obviously Steve Rodman here, the executive director of PERS. So how this has been set up is that, and so I, they can, if they feel comfortable, if they're ready, it wasn't clear to me if they were going to be ready for today or not, but they are going to do, they were reviewing the technical experts, which is what they are, like we did on Monday to be able to talk about them. I don't think DAS is here today. Oh, Madeline is here. Oh, well, there you are. Hi, she's in, she is here. I wasn't sure, so I wasn't sure if we could go forward, but we could. I think that probably would be good. I didn't know how long Senator Canope wanted to speak for, and I appreciate he's trying to keep it brief and covered it. I think we should, if Madeline and Steve are prepared to talk about the amendments, I think we should, there's a lot of overlap sure. between the two bills. So I would prefer, if it's okay with the committee, that I think that we should just have them come up and talk about we can have them come up and talk about the constitutionality of them as best as they know today, but they were not expected to have a final work product until next week.
And Madam Chair, I'm totally fine with that.
But I want to have questions answered.
I just
want to
make sure that there was that overview, if we're going to have that overview, we can do it today or next week. I'm fine. But
okay.
The
technical experts, like on Monday, will go we're working through to go through all the amendments, but we know the workload that we put on LC and in the agencies. But LC is right here. So if you feel you're ready to talk about the amendments, we can. We may call you back next week, though. Go over in more detail if you choose.
Chair Taylor, I think most of these concepts I opined about it in great detail I think it was an August opinion to Senator Canope that's become public. So I can talk about them now.
Okay. So we'll go ahead and have you talk about them. The question is we can have her do this now.
Sure.
We have folks who've signed up to testify. And we have Steve Rodman and DAS here. I want to be a little bit sensitive of time.
Totally understand.
So would folks like to hear from LC now before we hear the testimony about the constitutionality of each of these? Or would you prefer to, I'm willing to have folks weigh in on this because I don't know if you feel you need more information before you hear the testimony. Senator Montes Anderson, do you?
Well, it would be nice to know if they're legal or not, just quickly. I mean,
Senator Gelser.
I cut down some of the testimony. Yeah.
Okay, Senator Gelser.
I agree that would be helpful, just making sure that we're mindful and able to hear from the people that aren't in the building every day.
That's the only thing.
That's true, I agree.
Yeah,
I agree.
So I think that maybe we'll take if you don't mind, Marisa, I know you're so great, you're stood up and you're ready to come up, and that was, the plan was to have the bills and then to have folks testify, but I know you have a little bit of an advantage because you've been working on these, and of course you're the drafter, so you know them inside and out. So thank you.
Yep. And then just a further comment, if that a letter that you sent to Canope, we might have received it, but I certainly would like to have it in OLS.
I can post that.
Yeah.
So if we run out of time, I believe it will be because Senator Canope is a little bit late.
It is, and I apologize, and I would like to apologize with Moose Crunch popcorn.
Yeah,
chocolate.
Okay, well, back to business. Okay, so I'm going to call up Greg Harmon, Bob Livingston, and Melissa Unger, please. And let's see, what time is it? So maybe about, four minutes or so per person, if possible. Is Melissa Unger here? Oh, okay, hi. And because we have seven amendments, and I don't know if it's possible, if you can, I see that you explain that you are against the bill, in which for each of, if you can reference the amendment that you're speaking about, if it's possible in your testimony, then it would help because we're documenting everything and people are watching because the amendments, as you all know, have different impacts. So. Welcome. Nice to
Thank
see
you.
All of you.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for coming again, Mr. Harmon. People are still talking about your testimony with your with your former colleagues. So
always a pleasure to drive down here on a sunny day like today.
Yes, yes, I apologize. Only so much I can do. Yeah. So, and 1 second. So I think that we don't need the clock, I don't think so. But thank you so much, Debbie. It's a little stressful. Add a little stress to the room. So I have my little clock here. So, okay.
Do you want me to start?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you for having us here, members of the committee. I don't really have a presentation which focuses on each of the seven components because I really haven't had enough time to look at them. I will comment, though, that given her testimony and given my discussions with Marissa, I think our opinions about constitutionality are similar. They're not identical. There are some areas, particularly in detail and nuance, where I think we differ somewhat. One of the examples is the adoption of the PBGC rate, or the 3.5% for the money match benefit that appears both in the 913 bill as well as one of the, I think it's number two, anyway, one of the 560. I think she would say that's somewhat problematic. We say it's clearly unconstitutional. So that would be an area that we differ somewhat in terms of our analysis. And we believe that that's basically just a bill which impacts benefits based on service already performed. And as we know from the Morrow case, that really is something that you can't do. So we look at that one somewhat differently. And that's just an illustration, I think, of the differences that that we would have. They're not overwhelming, but there are differences in terms of how we look at these. One of the other areas, and I really focused on the $100,000 cap, which was part of the old 560, because there are differences in the way we think about the protection of benefits based on service already performed. And we believe that the way the bill was drafted previously for the $100,000 cap was not sufficient in protecting members' benefits based on service already performed. And there's a serious difference in terms of the actuarial analysis, assuming that you amend the bill to protect those benefits, which we think needs to be done. Because in my discussions with the actuaries, it would appear that of the $3.3 billion that they initially estimated would be the savings for that particular concept, if you protected benefits based on work performed the way we think they need to be done, that would probably drop to the neighborhood of $1.3 billion. So I think it's important to make certain that as you move forward and think about how you want to structure these bills, to make sure you have actuarial analysis which is consistent with the way they ultimately get drafted, because there can be some very, very significant differences depending on what seems like a fairly nuanced kind of position. But as you can see, it makes some big dollar differences. So moving on, I'd like to spend just a moment or two talking about some of your concepts that you have your, I think, seven concepts that you want to use to evaluate the bills, including fairness, impact on employer rates, impact on members. A word on the 6% diversion. It appears in Senate Bill 913 in a little different fashion, because instead of a straight-ahead diversion, it is a creation of a new account within the defined benefit with the projection of perhaps some money coming back to members if it's not necessary to pay for their pension. I would describe that politely as smoke and mirrors. I think it's the same proposal. Realistically, given the current assumptions about the system, which include an 8.5% rate for purchase of normal benefits in the OPSER position, it's clear that putting 6% into that account, unless you have truly extraordinary earnings over many, many years, will never reach a level where realistically anyone's going to get any money back from that account. So I make that point just to point out it is really the same proposal. And I think the same impact that you saw previously from some of our members testifying, thinking back to Mr. Silence and Ms. Jennifer Gould and Travis Overly, and you recall they came in and testified that the original bill as drafted would have depleted their individual account in the neighborhood of 50% to 75%. Same thing's going to happen under the 913 concept. It's really not going to be any different. So it is a very, very serious hit on IAP benefits. And finally, the last thing I was going to talk about, and I was mindful of your time limits, is that I want to talk about a proposal just to give you some sense of the impact. And it's a proposal to move the retirement age to age 67. Now, it's for new hires. There's no legal issue. So I'm not talking about legal issues now, but I'm talking about fundamental fairness. One of the things that it does, and I think you need to be very careful when you read it, not only does it move the retirement age to age 67, but it also eliminates one of the core concepts of PERS, which is that you ought to get a full pension if you've worked a full career, and a full career has always been understood to be 30 years. That would no longer be part of the OPSERP system moving forward. Now, let me give you some numbers just to give you some sense of the impact of that change. Because going from age 65 to 67 for retirement doesn't sound like a huge change, but when you combine that with the elimination of the 30-year full benefit, it becomes a very significant change. And just to give you some illustration, I went to the current average retiree 2015 out of the PERS system. In other words, average of all the people who retired in 2015. They receive a pension benefit of a little over $32,000. Their salary at retirement was a little over $72,000. And their retirement age was age 62, and on average they had 24 years of service. Now let's just take our current OPSERP statute and do a rough calculation for what the benefit would be for someone retiring from OPSERP. And I know OPSERP hasn't been around for 24 years, but assuming we could wave our magic wand and go back, that same person retiring with 24 years of service, age 62, instead of a benefit of $32,000 under current law, would receive a benefit of approximately $22,000. And the reason for that is because there is a serious adjustment in their benefit due to the fact that they are retiring early. In other words, they're retiring before they reach their full retirement age. There's an actuarial reduction. They lose about $10,000. Same number of years of service, same date. If we take our imaginary OPSERP member and we project them out and say, well, let's see what happens if they work a full 30 years under current statute. Well, things get better because that bumps them up to almost the same amount, $32,000 plus, that a Tier 1, Tier 2, or a current member retiring would get. So in other words, by working six additional years under the current system, they can achieve the same benefit that is achieved by a member in 24 years. But if we take the new bill and we say, okay, 67 years, that's what you have to work to get to full retirement, and we eliminate the 30 years and out full retirement concept, according to my rough calculations, that individual comes in at about $22,000. So in other words, they've dropped back a significant amount because they didn't work all the way to age 67. Another way of thinking about this is a brand new teacher hired next year at age 25 is going to be told the only way you could get full retirement is to work for 42 years. Now, I don't know whether retired teachers working for 42 years is good or bad policy, but it strikes me that that's something that ought to be a very serious concern by the committee before you go down this road. So, again, as you think about these concepts, please ask what's being accomplished here. I note for a number of these concepts, you have no actuarial analysis yet, so you really have no way of determining, I mean, what is the impact on the system in terms of employer rates. At this point, I don't think you have any analysis of the impact on individuals, but we'll be happy to provide that at the appropriate time. But again, we're looking at complex issues, complex system. And, you know, those of us who work in PERS regard it as the land of unintended consequences. And I think Mr. Rodman would tell you the same thing, that over the years changes have been made, and often those changes have differed significantly from what I think the legislature intended. So happy to answer any questions if you have them. I'm sorry, I'm not prepared to go through the seven amendments, but I suspect that my opinion would be similar to Marissa's when she has a chance to do that with you.
Okay, thank you. I actually have one question. Can you go back to the $100,000 cap?
Sure.
And just explain again, in the original bill in 560, obviously it's not indexed. Mm-hmm. And so what it is that you, I'll say, use the term like and dislike about the way it is, I assume, I know you don't like the way that it is now, but if it were indexed, then what would be your thoughts on it? If you can answer on the fly,
sure.
I'm not sure.
Oh, no, I'm happy to do that. It's not the indexing that's the question. Indexing is the problem with failing to index is, of course, you catch more and more people as you go down the road. $100,000 in today's dollars, it's a lot of dollars. 25, 30 years from now, it's not going to be quite as many dollars, and so you'll scoop more and more people into that. But I'm talking about something very different. And let me give you an illustration. let's say we have a member who at the time of the passage of the bill has worked half his or her career, 15 years, and let's say that at the time that the bill passes, they're earning $90,000 a year. They complete their career. At the end of their career, they're earning $130,000 a year. We believe that the only way you can adequately protect benefits based on service already performed, because after all, during the period of time that individual is performing that service, he or she understood that their final benefit for that service would be based on their final salary. We think the only way you can protect that is to protect that 15 years and say that 15 years has to be based on full final salary, $130,000 in our example. The last 15 years, which is the 15 years after the passage of the bill, and again, setting aside other legal arguments, could be valued at the $100,000 if that was the cap. So I'm really talking about a difference in terms of how you protect benefits based on service already performed. And again, we think the way you do that is consistently with the way the court said we're going to do it in the COLA case, in the Morrow case, consistently with how we did it many years ago in the tax case, the Hughes case, and that is to do split periods of service. So in other words, you end up with your first period of service being calculated consistent with the laws that existed at the time that you rendered that service, the second block of your service being calculated at whatever the legislature says the new deal is going to be. And again, I'm jumping over things like irrevocable benefits and so forth. I'm just trying to explain the comments I made about the need to protect benefits based on service already performed.
Okay. All right. Any questions?
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Unger.
Hi, Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Canope. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm the political director of SEIU Local 503. I was able to testify in the last hearing, so I'm going to try not to repeat myself. And I want to respond to some of the proposals specifically, but also just some of the pieces of conversation that's been happening in the committee. And there's one important fact that I feel like is important to remember. In 2007, under the same retirement plan that gave out the exact same benefits as we have today, we had a fund that was funded at 110%, with side accounts at 97%. All the same benefits, even more Tier 1 and Tier 2 workers were in the system. And by 2008, we had lost approximately $17 billion from the Wall Street crash, and we were about 70% funded with outside accounts. And while all the conversations that have happened in this committee about the decisions in the 90s and the benefits are completely true and the employer rates are increasing and all of that is an accurate and good conversation, we think it's also missing the conversation of where did this UAL actually come from? And it was in the same situation where big banks hadn't crashed our economy, we probably wouldn't be in this place. And they got off scot-free in 2008, and now I feel like we're talking about it again, where retirees and middle-class Oregonians are going to be left holding the bag. And that same recession brought pay cuts to our members through mandatory furloughs and step freezes at the time, and at the same time they were meeting unprecedented demand. And then in 2013, when the legislature passed the COLA reductions for retirees and then passed a budget based on those COLA reductions, even though I think we were clear that we thought they would be illegal, most of the increase to the UAL today is because of the decision to not fund much of that that unfunded liability that happened from 2008. And so I included in my testimony that you all have in OLIS, or will have, I sent it a little late, sorry, just like the we use this map when I talk to our members. We talk to our members a lot about what's driving this UAL. And I included the things that are driving the UAL this time, right now. This, I think it's $9.5 billion increase in the UAL. And more than 50% of that was the Morrow decision in 2013. And by not paying for the 2008 crash from 2013 to today, we have just made this problem worse. And I feel like we can talk about all the benefits, we can talk about all the challenges the system's facing, but it is unfair to talk about those things and not talk about how we got here. And if we have a $21 billion UAL, and approximately $17 billion of that was derived from a one-time event, is the system as unstable as people are claiming it is? And is it benefits that are driving all of these problems when we had a system that was 110% funded with the exact same benefits that are being provided today? Actually, a little less, I guess, the COLA changed from 2007 to now. And I also, I think we talked about this and Greg referred to it, but in Senate Bill 913 continues the proposal that would end the individual account program as we know it, which is a 6% reduction to a person's compensation. And I think I mentioned this at the last year hearing, but our state workers, they pay that 6% reduction. They chose to take that on in the last bargaining with the state, and we got a lower COLA because of that choice to take on that 6%. And that diversion will have a serious impact on future employees. I think we've heard from a teacher where their IAP would be reduced by 75% in the average retirement, the average IAP overall retirement package that we saw reduced from the actuarial analysis that we did was between 30 and 40%. And I think in these proposals, just like the previous ones we talked about, it really is OPSERP members who are gonna feel the brunt of these changes, even though I think if you, all the reports continue to show that OPSERP members are not the people who are getting the benefits as derived in, that have been talked about, and it is now their money paying for their IAP, and I think that's a really big piece. I do want to address the age piece from a different perspective than I think what Greg just addressed. I think that not only do we want our state workers to be highly qualified, but I think we should also recognize that the work that they do is hard. During my last testimony, I mentioned Brandy from the state hospital, who's had 9 concussions and is on her second medical leave, or the ODOT worker who throughout the winter is on call 24 hours a day trying to keep our roads clear and often works 24-hour shifts during a snowstorm, or the child welfare worker where in a recent audit, 73% of them said they feel highly stressed in their jobs. And how are these workers supposed to help and support children after 30 years of working some of the hardest cases and at the age of 67. The jobs police and fire do are very hard, which is why they have a lower retirement age, but so are many of the other jobs that frontline workers do. And to increase their age to 4 years longer than the average retirement age, I don't think is a clear sign of the respect that they do. As I said in my earlier testimony, state workers on Oregon make, on average, 98% of their private sector peers in total compensation. When talking about just wages, it's 88% of their private sector peers. This does not leave a lot of room for people to save for their retirements, which is why PERS is so essential for their retirement security. We don't want the state to become an employer of last resort. The frontline workers of the state are the face of our government. They interact with the people at the DMV. They are the people that work with children who are most in need. They help a family who needs help paying for benefits, and they help our seniors navigate a complicated web of services. We need to be able to recruit the best and retain the best, and that is not possible, we believe, if you cut further benefits. Our position on Senate Bill 913 is the same as our position on 560. These reductions continue to be extreme and break the contract with the state's dedicated public workforce. Thank you. And I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay. All right. Okay. Welcome, Senator Johnson.
Thank you.
Thanks. We're hearing both Senate Bill 560 and 913, and 560 has 7 amendments. And if we can get a copy of those to you.
I have them. I was testifying on another bill. I apologize.
Just wanted to make sure you're up to speed on what we're doing.
I'm up to speed.
Okay. Well, we're going to hear from third person testifying, Mr. Livingston. Hello.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Livingston, President of the Oregon State Firefighters Council. And I'm also proud to note that for over 25 years, I've been a member of the Oregon Fire Service and am an active PERS member to this day. I want to steal a little bit of a line because I think it really does do a good job of illustrating and putting things in context. We've had a lot of hearings on PERS and all that, and I really would like to kind of talk a little bit about what is the goal and purpose of these proposals. Mr. Rodeman, I think, asked that question, and I think it's a fair question. And I think in the context, when we look at Senate Bill 913 and Senate Bill 560 and the plethora of amendments, the bottom line is many of those reduce benefits. Well, if the goal is to reduce benefits, then technically I guess those bills are all right. Having said that, though, I think it is important to remember that from a benefit standpoint, we've already addressed that. We have controlled the cost of benefits to a large degree, and as a reminder, much of that happened in the 2003 reforms, when not only did we do a lot of significant changes to PERS Tier 1 and Tier 2 people, but we also established a new OPSERP pension plan that was a reduced plan, and we already know that already half of the public workforce is under that reduced plan. We've heard about upwards of 40 to 70% reductions in benefits benefits to those individuals. But the bottom line is, if we would stop from a public policy standpoint and look at what the true goal of this exercise is, we have controlled benefit costs. And let me give you an illustration. These aren't my numbers. These are PERS numbers. In coincidentally, in 2002, the average replacement salary was 68% of a person's final average salary. In 2015, that number is down to 44%. And so clearly, by PERS by the numbers, and if you look at what we've done with the establishment of OPSERP, with what we've done to contain benefits, 68% down to 44% in 14 years is a significant number. And so as I look at these on behalf of the members I represent and fellow public workers, I also like to look at these things from the context of the criteria that the community is established. And one of those, and I think it was referenced early, is the order of magnitude and savings. And I think the esteemed counselor mentioned this. And it's, if you look at any of the Milliman reports, there's really two things that I think as you move forward, you need to really pay attention to. And the first one is, and I'm just going to quote it because it's in the bold of all the actuarial analysis. Please note that if multiple concepts are implemented together, the resulting effect would not be the cumulative amount of the separate concepts illustrated below. Instead, the interactions between the various benefit modifications would produce a liability reduction of smaller magnitude than the sum of the reductions shown below. If more than one concept will be incorporated into a legislative proposal, a separate analysis should be conducted to study the combined effects. It further goes on to talk about you also, and they can't make into consideration of the behaviors of the members of the system. Meaning, hey, if some of these proposals, impact long-term members larger, and such as the changing the assumed rate of return and changing that from the money match methodology, well, one thing I can tell you as a PERS member and who fields a plethora of calls in that area, those people are simply going to retire if they're going to see a reduced benefit. You're not going to capture that, but what until after the fact. One thing we have heard from Mr. Rodeman is, and this is a fact, this is, again, PERS by the numbers, every time this legislative body has a whole litany of discussions and it looks like there might be something done with PERS, here's what we do know. We see a spike in retirements. And so another criteria that I think as we deliberate and have further discussions on PERS is we need to recognize as one of those criteria, impact on public employee workforce. What do we know? We know that over 68,000 are eligible to retire right now. Many of those operate in a 24/7 environment, in whether that's at the Oregon State Hospital, whether that's at a local fire department, a local police department, the Oregon State Police. When you combine some of what I'm hearing from my members and know that those are 24/7 operations, you may save some dollars in the short term over here, but what are those costs going to be in personal services in to include overtime, to include all of the, some of the safety considerations that you have when you have brain drain issues and some of those things that are a matter of life and death. I can point to the fire service and you can point to law enforcement. There's a lot of people that are at that age that are at command positions that are eligible to retire. And so those have huge impacts on that. And so as those criteria, you need to continue to look at that. Another one that is part of the criteria, equitability of cost and benefits to a public employees. Well, what do we know? We know that 70% of the unfunded liability is for members who are retired who have left the workforce. But yet you've heard testimony from members, and I think counselor had mentioned their names, upwards of 40 to 70% reduction. Well, when I look at that criteria on equitability of cost and benefits, the savings is very minimal compared to the 50 to the 70% reduction an individual is going to see in their benefits. And then finally, the one thing that I want to spend a little bit of time on, because we haven't really got into this, and in my experience, in the legislature, you really don't hear about this. I think that Mr. Rodeman could speak to this, but somebody that's been dealing with PERS for over 22 years and a member, I field a lot of calls from PERS members. And one of the things that's a criteria is administrative feasibility. And if I can, for just a second, I want to applaud the great work over the years that Mr. Rodeman and his staff have done to try to be responsive to members, to provide to them accurate and timely information. But I think it's important for those that are maybe new to this committee or this, we've had terrible examples where we've had to come in front of this legislature to illustrate where mistakes were made, where bad information was given. K-Bell rings a bell, which led to a lot of changes and some things. These are awful decisions. And so one of the things, I think people are listening. People pay attention, and this is the body. The legislature is the plan sponsor. And so the impacts in the decisions that you make, the wave goes out, and people hear about that. And so as part of that administrative feasibility, one of the things that you need to remember, and again, a lot of compliments go to Mr. Rodeman and staff. They do their very best. And in fact, one of their goals is this, and I'll quote, "We serve the people of Oregon by administering public employee benefit trust to pay the right person the right benefit at the right time." And so if you look at some of these bills, whether it's, you know, a reduction in the multiplier and all that, one of the things that they've done a good job is you can go online and do an online estimator and all that. Well, if you're at a retirement age or close to that and the legislature looks like they may do a smorgasbord of changes, how is a person going to be able to get timely and accurate information? How are they going to make a good decision on arguably maybe the most important decision that they make? And so when I look at your criteria on administrative feasibility, some of these proposals, particularly with the proposal on the timeframes, I think that's nearly going to be impossible. And I would just end with this. Whether it's K-Bell, whether it's some of my individuals, and I know people right now that have called me on the phone and said, you know what? I wished I wouldn't retired because I heard that the Oregon legislature was going to do this. Well, they ended up not doing that. Or I wished I wouldn't have retired, and now I don't have a job because 2 years later the Oregon Supreme Court overturned those things. And so I appreciate the opportunity and time to testify on these two proposals as it relates to Senate Bill 560, Senate Bill 913, and the amendments. But so far, as I do my own analysis of the establishment of the criteria that you've put in place, many of these proposals simply don't pass that test. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Anyone have any questions? Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to call up Mindy Merritt, Rhonda Morgan, and Nadine Sanbo. And I was hoping to give everyone a little more lenient on time, but we will have to narrow it down a little bit so that, because we're going to have some questions, I'm sure, of Mr. Rodeman at the end, and perhaps LC. So. Welcome.
Thank you.
State your name, and maybe you've been here before, I don't know, or state your name and who you're with, please.
Thank you very much. Would you like me just to go ahead and go?
That's perfect.
Chair Taylor and members of the committee, my name is Melinda Hagerman Merritt, and I reside at 2381 Teal Drive, Southeast Salem. I am here before you representing Salem-Keizer Education Association, our certified educators, and the opposition of Senate Bill 913 and Senate Bill 560. I believe I was born with a calling to be an educator. I come from a family of teachers. My father was an industrial arts teacher for 32 years, and now retired, and my mother, a retired kindergarten teacher. This is my 25th year as a certified educator, and I currently serve as the president of the Salem-Keizer Education Association. Senate Bill 913 and Senate Bill 560 are an unfair and extreme attack on teachers like me and the educators that I speak for. As a teacher, I have felt honored within my profession and within my community. But in my 25 years teaching in Oregon, I do not feel that way from our elected leaders. When my father first began as an educator, a promise was made to work for less than what he could earn in a different profession in exchange for a secure retirement that valued the contributions that he would make over his 32 years in his profession. This promise is not true for our early career educators, and these two Senate bills will completely eradicate this promise for all people entering the profession. For as long as I can remember, the legislature has tried one attack on educators' retirement benefits after another, constantly telling the story that educators and other public servants are the cause of all of Oregon's budget woes. This is offensive to educators. The retirement system is our delayed salaries that we, as professionals, are due and would have earned in any other field. What's worse, these attacks do not do much to solve the unfunded liability in PERS. The reality is that this will simply exacerbate existing problems to include the difficulty attracting and retaining qualified educators. In my work as president, I have the honor of working with our early career educators who are passionate about education and our profession. They enter their career with not only a four-year degree, but frequently a master's degree, and are already burdened with extreme debt from student loans. In a world where we advocate for public education, we strive to hire the best and the brightest to teach our future leaders. The elimination of the IAP program for new hires, reducing their retirement by 31%, will be the final straw that forces those considering the pursuit of a career in education to seek a different profession that is valued. I urge you to reject these unfair and extreme attacks on educators' retirement benefits and fulfill the promise that was made in exchange for retirement benefits for educators and the people who serve Oregon's children. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. My name is Nadine Sanbo. I work as an eligibility specialist at Cascade West Council of Governments in Albany. Previous to that, I was with Oregon Health Plan. I've worked as a public employee for about a year and a half. I'm an SEIU member, and I'm here to testify in opposition to SB 913 and SB 560. I recently finished my education at OSU, which I decided to pursue after becoming deeply concerned with the inequality I see occurring in this state. My passion was and still is to contribute to an effective system which promotes wellness for workers and the citizens we serve. A vision of collaboration, prevention, wellness, and even creativity that many of our leaders claim is their own vision for those residing in our state. Upon entering social services at the state level, I quickly became disheartened by the work situations occurring for my coworkers. Though the intent and vision is wellness for all Oregonians, what is occurring in our state is far from it. Unhealthy working conditions, lower wages, and burnout are only a few of the issues our public servants are faced with. As if social service jobs are not difficult enough, now workers are faced with an attack on their retirement funds. The attacks are extreme and simply unfair. Workers are faced with the potential to become the very population that we serve. Additionally, when you pass legislation like this, you risk placing those providing services in the position of needing services due to poverty levels of income in their retirement age. Passing legislation like this communicates that providing services for Oregonians is not valued and will not be honored at the time of retirement. Devaluing our public servants who are already faced with some of the most challenging positions in this state. This type of decision is demoralizing to employees and creates a clear message to future generations regarding the state's leaders' priorities, what they value, and what type of culture they will promote for Oregonians. This is not a solution. These proposals will not mitigate the large unfunded liability. It is an attempt to push an issue on younger generations and avoid responsibility of an issue that we have had no part in. The answer is creating revenue, not pushing public servants into poverty during their retirement years. Continually placing budget issues on the backs of working families is the reason we are facing our current crisis. I challenge you to create new solutions to this issue as opposed to repeating the same decisions that have created our current climate of uncertainty and insecurity for Oregonians. You should start with addressing the fact that we are dead last in the nation for corporate taxes. Thank you.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm Rhonda Morgan, and I work at DHS in the self-sufficiency program. I'm a case manager, and I work with families who are in the domestic violence program, the temporary assistance to needy families program, and the employment-related daycare programs. As part of that, I also determine eligibility for food stamps. I'm an SEIU member, and I serve as the elected president that represents all the workers in DHS and OHA. I'm here to testify in opposition to both SB 560 and SB 913. I've been employed with DHS since January of 2004. I actually started volunteering in August of 2003, but I wasn't hired until January, so I missed Tier 2 by just that much. I'd been a stay-at-home mom for the previous 13 years, and when I moved to Oregon with my three young children, we came with basically what we had on and absolutely no prospect of ever having a retirement fund. My youngest son was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in August of 2003. So when I was hired by the state in January, the following January, I was thrilled that I was going to be able to cover my children with high-quality, affordable medical coverage. So now it's 13 years later. My children have all grown, and they're off on their next chapter of their adventures. And I find myself living alone, wondering, how am I going to support myself when I'm no longer able to work? By entering the workforce so late, I don't have a lot of Social Security history built up. Being in Tier 3, or OPSERP, all I can really contribute to my retirement is the 6% of my salary that goes to my IAP. My manager has also been with DHS in Gold Beach for just over 30 years. She started as a volunteer, like I did, and she's worked in the same small community all of those years. First as a receptionist, then as an eligibility worker, then as a case manager. Now she's our operations manager in my office. She was actually my case manager when the kids and I came to Oregon. She tells me that she doesn't want to retire. She loves what she does. But when looking at these PERS bills, she said, it looks like the state's going to reduce my retirement with these bills. Why should I give more of my life to a place that's only going to take away from me? SB 560 and SB 913 would decimate my retirement, and they are inherently unfair, in my opinion. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. One of my coworkers who couldn't be here also submitted a testimony in opposition to SB 560 and 913, and you can find that in OLIS. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Does anyone have any questions? Okay. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We'll call up Michael Savaggio, Jose Payden, I believe, and Tyler Shipman, please. And then has anyone else, Debbie, asked to sign up besides the one you gave me, the letter you gave me? Okay. Okay, we'll start with you, Mr. Savaggio.
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Savaggio. I'm here representing the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs. We represent line officers and sheriff's deputies around the state. And every day, our members go about their jobs, keeping our communities safe, whether that's investigating past crimes, preemptively preventing others, or sometimes something as simple as engagement with residents and simple safety measures. But every single day, they are prepared in every sense of the word to put their lives on the line in protecting those communities. And too often, we see officers end their watch in tragic circumstances. But that is the deal that they have with their communities. When a perilous situation arises, our members are bound to carry out their duties and step into the fray. They don't have the luxury of renegotiating the terms of their employment or their responsibilities, even in the face of existential threats. Sadly, those stories sometimes end up here in this building in the form of a resolution honoring those officers, and it is fitting and proper that we do this. But there is an opportunity now to honor the current commitments of those officers who are still with us, and that is to recognize that a deal is a deal. Our officers and deputies fulfill their commitments, and we expect the state to honor its commitments. Our members took on a career in law enforcement with certain understandings that the protection of their benefits was going to occur, and we ask you to respect those commitments and Opposed, Senate Bill 913 and 560.
No. Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Canope, Senators, members of the committee, my name is Jose Padin. I am faculty of Portland State University, where I've worked for 20 years, a bit over. I'm also president of the American Association of University Professors State of Oregon Conference. Thank you very much for your service to the State of Oregon and for the opportunity to communicate with you today. On behalf of the more than 1,300 members of the American Association of University Professors in Oregon, faculty members, members at the faculty union at the University of Oregon and Portland State University and at private and public universities across the state, I'm coming here to ask that you please oppose Senate Bills 913 and Senate Bill 560 with its amendments. And its actual effect on working Oregonians, as we see it, both SB 913 and SB 560 with the amendments would have a similar impact. In the sector that I work in, public higher education, faculty will take a big hit. And we will lose faculty, and we will have an even more difficult time attracting talent. And it's difficult already in Oregon. These days, many professors, our industry is looking pretty bad for many professors, are part-time with low salaries. Some don't even have health care benefits. And Oregon public universities offer salaries that are very uncompetitive, not surprising. We rank 46th in the nation in our investment. At Portland State, where I work, faculty salaries are in the bottom 10% for PhD-granting institutions. It's very difficult to compete on salary grounds. Retirement and related benefits that offer some kind of stability in one's life are one of the few remaining ways we have to attract anyone who might find Oregon an attractive place to come anymore. Oregon made a promise to its hardworking citizens, and it really needs to keep its promise in this area. On the other hand, when we break these promises, we give Oregon a reputation that makes it very, very difficult to hire talent, because not only can we not compete with immediate incentives, but if someone takes a job not imagining that the state of Oregon is going to change its mind every couple of years, hard time. And some SB and 913 and 560 represent a clear threat to the secure retirement of many hardworking Oregonians. And as such, it really constitutes, at least in my sector, higher education, a significant disinvestment in our higher education system. And it actually moves us away from our long-term push to significantly raise the percentage of Oregonians with college educations. Right now, even without this, something like 40-40-20, it really seems like pie in the sky. We need to be investing in the system, not disinvesting. For these reasons, we ask that you please oppose these bills. Thank you.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, my name is Tyler Shipman. I am a government relations specialist with the Oregon School Employees Association. We represent over 21,000 school employees in the state of Oregon. Some of our employees include bus drivers, custodians, and educational assistants. I'm here today to speak in opposition of Senate Bill 913 as well as 560 with the amendments. I'll be real brief and just try to speak to how this affects more of actually my particular membership. I think it's important to understand with classified staff that our members truly aren't getting rich off the retirement system right now. Our members currently have an average salary of only $24,000 a year. This equates to just a couple hundred dollars a month in retirement benefits as it is. In fact, most of our members actually continue to work after retirement in order to make ends meet. We're worried that these changes would push future retirees just further into poverty and making life more difficult for them after they retire. As it was mentioned earlier, ending the IEP would be a 6% reduction in benefits, with our members already low wages that are sometimes just barely over minimum wage. We're worried that this is really going to create a problem in attracting qualified individuals. We think this is a really important issue when we're discussing education, and especially the people dealing with our youth, not only interacting with them, but also educating them. We have a real particular problem, too, by increasing the age to 67 in order to retire for PERS. We're worried about the impact that this would have on our members. More specifically, we have members working in special education that are already getting hurt as it is. Increasing this age would only increase the likelihood that they would get injured as they continue to work those additional years. I haven't been able to really go over all of the amendments that have been offered in the 560, Senate Bill 560 today, but more specifically, we have a real concern with the Dash 9 amendment, which would increase the service hours from 600 to 1,000 for vetting employees into the PERS system. This is a real issue for us right now, especially because most of our members truly strive and try to get 600 hours a year just to make it into the system. And for most of them, it's really difficult, not only because of school districts' current budget issues, but also by the fact that most of our employees only work the length of the school year, which might only be 9 to 10 months. We're worried that we'll have a large, significant chunk of employees that will be kind of caught in the middle who aren't vested yet, but maybe have 2 or 3 years. And then once this new increase to 1,000 comes up, they won't be able to meet that requirement and they'll be lost. So for these reasons, OSCA does not support the Senate Bill 913 or 560 with the amendments.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay, well, thank you for coming up. We have one last person, Tim Cowan, asked to testify.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If you think my testimony that I provided you is not relevant to what the testimony is, not from everybody else, I don't need to.
Well, sir, why don't you sit down and state your name for the record? We just have a way we do it. We just state your name, please, and who you're with, and then we can talk about it a little bit. So thank you.
Chair and committee members, my name is Tim Cowan for the record.
Okay, and who are you with? Are you
just myself.
Yourself? Fantastic. We like to have citizens come to the Capitol. Welcome. I see the letter that I read really quickly here. We are discussing Senate Bill 913 and 560. Did you want to talk about the bills, or we could go ahead and put on what we call OLIS, make it publicly available, the document that you submitted? Which would you prefer?
I have it on OLIS.
Okay,
so
great.
Well, the public can find it there.
Okay, all right. Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Cowan? You are okay. All right. Thank you, sir. I just wanted to get it on the record so that you were treated the same as everyone else. I appreciate it. Okay, so that's everyone who has signed up to testify. We do have Mr. Rudman here. LC is, you know, back working away, doing what they do, and can come back. And we have DAS here. Again, they're going to go over the specifics of the bill to against the criteria that they've been asked to evaluate all the bills and the amendments against. But for the testimony that was given, or if we have any specific questions, we can call Mr. Rodman up. Does anybody have anything that they want to go over? Senator Hansel, or?
I'm willing to, if we're going to have the.
Would you rather
on,
wait and do it? Or
yeah,
or
it might be better to have everybody together at the same time and.
Okay, that's fine. I just wanted to make certain for what was discussed so far, if there was anything that anyone wanted clarified or anything. Yes, Senator Sanderson.
I was interested in what Felisa Higgins, Melissa Unger said. Due to the crash in 2007, We were funded at 110% in 2006. Is that what I heard? And then when the banks crashed, or when Wall Street crashed, when everybody crashed, we went into that depression. Then our unfunded liability was decreased. I mean, yeah. So we were not funded at, I forget what was said. So I just need that clarified again.
Sure.
Mr. Rudman, it's amazing how you just can feel a PERS movement and you just appear here at the. That's impressive. It must be happened to you quite often now. So.
For the record, my name is Steve Rodman. I'm the executive director of PERS. Chair Taylor, Senator Mona Sanderson, the funded status is measured at the end of every calendar year. So Ms. Unger was quoting statistics from our PERS by the Numbers, which is a publication that we update a couple times a year. And as of the end of 2007, which was before most of the market correction was put on the books, if you will. With side accounts, we were about 111% funded, and without side accounts, we were 97% funded. Then when assets dropped some 40% through the course of 2008 and even into part of 2009, when we again did the valuation at the end of 2008, funded status had dropped as much as she had stated. So she, I think, generally accurately quoted the funding status change that occurred because of that. And also the change in the unfunded liability, which went from a surplus of some $6 billion to a negative of some $10 or $11 billion.
Thank you. Okay. And then if you, can you also just clarify the Morrow, Ms. Unger also referred to the Morrow decision in the last, I know we went over this in previous testimony, but if you could just clarify about what the, I think she mentioned the 17 billion overall, and then the more recent impact from the Morrow decision of not being able to make the payments at the time. If you could just kind of explain to folks the contributing impact of that, because there was the 08 situation, and then we have the Morrow decision.
So
everyone understands, please.
Sure. Chair Taylor, in 2013, the legislature adopted restrictions and reductions in the cost of living that applied to people who had already retired as well as people who continue to work. The Supreme Court reversed that. So the 2013 employer rates were predicated on the savings from that COLA reduction. So part of the legislation directed PERS to reissue employer contribution rates for 2013. So the rates that were charged and paid by employers in 2013 and through 2015 took into account as if those benefit reductions were upheld. So to some way of thinking, that could be they were underfunded or underpaid during that period of time, because ultimately those benefits were restored back. When those benefits were restored back by the court's decision, that was first reflected in our valuation closing December 31 of 2014. That contributed $5.1 billion to the unfunded liability by putting those cost of living adjustments back on the books.
Okay. Does anybody need anything else clarified while we have Mr. Rodman here? Okay. All right. So then anything else?
Marissa came back in.
Okay. Oh, would you like to have her come? Okay. So we're going to call up. Thank you.
Sure.
Maybe you could just stay. I was thinking suspicion that, you know, why go back and forth? And
I need my steps.
Yes. You know, don't we all? Ms. Marissa, thank you for coming back.
Chair Taylor, Marissa James, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. So how do you want me to go ahead?
Do you have a question or over anything in general?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do. Marissa, Mr. Hartman indicated that the way he interpreted the way the bill is drafted for the $100,000 cap, that it doesn't sufficiently separate between earned benefit versus benefit going forward. Would you agree with that? Because I think he was suggesting that the savings that the actuaries did, he thinks, are based on, I guess, the cap being instituted on all salary for a career, including going back. So could you comment on that?
Yeah, Chair Taylor, Senator Knope, sure. So I think we don't exactly know the answer to what the court would approve in terms of how you apply the change. I think Mr. Hartman's argument is plausible. I think the counter argument would be that the employee on the effective date has not earned the right to the higher salary that the employee will earn at the end of their career, and that seems consistent with Morrow to me. However, if you wanted to be on the safe side, you might amend the bill to reflect his understanding.
Okay.
You want to ask any? Does anybody have any other questions for LC? Again, we'll go over all the concepts in more detail on Monday. We're going to go through each of the amendments with the full technical experts, and people have a little more time to prepare questions if they want. So, all right. Thank you. And our next meeting, again, is on Monday, March 20th, 2017. We're, again, going to have the technical experts. And I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 560 and 913. And if we did receive, I want to make sure before we close the whole meeting, We did receive two more emails from folks that had general concepts. The deadline was February 28th. I think that they've been largely reviewed already, but we can talk about those on Monday with the technical experts as well. So just wanted to get that on the record. I want to thank everyone for coming, and I know we've run over many times, but today is a day we're going to get out a half hour early. So that's a miracle. So I'm going to adjourn the meeting, Senate Committee on Workforce.